Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here, and it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. Hello Fresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. Hello Fresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Hello. Welcome back to Say Why to Drugs after a somewhat more lengthy than I intended hiatus. I'm Susie Gage, a lecturer and researcher at the University of Liverpool. I have lots of exciting news since I last spoke to you, but I'll save that for after the episode, which is a special one as it's the first Say Why to Drugs live. This was recorded last week in front of an audience of psychology undergrad students and assorted others, and focused on the question, how do drugs affect the brain? Something that I've touched on in previous episodes, but not really fully explored on the podcast. I'm joined by my friend and colleague, psychopharmacologist Dr. Carl Roberts, who you might remember from the Cognitive Enhancers episode. This is a long one, so I'm going to stop waffling on here, but join me at the end to hear more exciting news. And for now, listen to Carl and I say why to How Drugs Affect the Brain live.
Susie Gage.
I've started recording and I picked up a microphone which obviously isn't connected to speakers, so you can't hear me any louder, but it is recording into my special little friend here. Hello, and thank you for coming to the first ever live edition of Say Why to Drugs. My name is Dr. Susie Gage. I'm a lecturer here at the University of Liverpool, and I'm particularly interested in understanding associations between recreational drug use and mental health. And for this special live episode, I am joined by my colleague, Dr. Carl Roberts.
Hello.
would you like to introduce yourself?
I'm Dr. Carl Roberts. And I'm a researcher of psychopharmacology.
Great. So this special, I've got to stop saying it's special because what if it's not special? This edition of Say Why to Drugs is specifically focusing around something that I haven't really touched on in many of the episodes to date, and that's how do recreational drugs affect the brain? We've got a few sort of questions lined up, and we've also asked people who are in the audience to submit questions beforehand, so we've got a couple of audience questions. But before we start talking about how drugs affect the brain, I thought it might be useful to have a little bit of a kind of explainer about the brain and neurons and neurotransmitters. So we know that the brain is made up of billions of brain cells called neurons, and that electrochemical signals are passed from neuron to neuron by chemicals that are released across the gaps between neurons, which are called synapses. These chemicals are neurotransmitters, and we've got loads of different ones, don't we?
Yep.
Okay, so that begs the question, how do recreational drugs impact on this?
It's a good question. So basically, drugs work on, in terms of neurotransmission, would work on one of two broad mechanisms. So usually a drug would either mimic an endogenous ligand for a receptor, so that means something that the body produces of its own accord to bind to receptors. So cannabis and heroin would be good examples of drugs that mimic a chemical that's produced within the body themselves. And then the other broad way that they function is to have some effect on a classic neurotransmitter which is produced in the body. So you might see a kind of a big stimulation of the release of monoamine small molecule neurotransmitter, or you might see that it stops the reuptake of a neurotransmitter. So one mechanism of action would be that it mimics the body's own neurotransmitters, and another one would be that it stimulates the release of or blocks the reuptake of a classic neurotransmitter.
Okay, so let's...
So examples, it's probably good to best explain with examples, isn't it? So some of the body's own neurotransmitters, these monoamine neurotransmitters, the most famous ones are probably dopamine and serotonin.
Yeah, so let's start off then with the ones that mimic our own neurotransmitters. Because we have an endocannabinoid system in our brains, don't we? Does that mean that our brains make cannabis?
Well, kind of, in a way. The active ingredient in cannabis, which is THC, works on specific receptors in the brain called cannabinoid receptors. So the ones in the brain are CB1 receptors. Our brains produce their own chemicals, which would normally bind to these receptors. So that's under our normal regulatory function. So we produce a chemical called anandamide, which actually comes from the Sanskrit, meaning joy or delight. And so that is basically something that is produced, and the endocannabinoid system kind of is involved in our normal regulation of mood and appetite and pleasure, pain as well. What I would normally say is what's quite interesting about studying plants or plant-based drugs such as cannabis is that they act on receptors in the brain, and studying them has told us quite important insights into our normal regulatory physiology, because these receptors aren't just in our brains sitting there waiting for us to take drugs. So it's not that someone that has never taken cannabis or has never taken heroin doesn't know what it feels like to not have their CB1 receptor stimulated or an opioid receptor stimulated. It's just that these drugs work on these receptors, so they mimic our body's own regulation of these processes that these systems are involved in.
Yeah, so these kind of drugs can really tell us a lot about how our own brains work, sort of regardless of the use of recreational drugs.
Absolutely.
It wasn't called the endocannabinoid system before we discovered cannabis and the impact of cannabis on
our exactly. Brain. So it's named after cannabis. With these drugs and with opioids, like such as heroin and morphine, the drugs themselves, the molecules in the drugs themselves are isolated first, and then the receptor systems that they work on were then kind of like discovered afterwards, because it was kind of, you know, researchers thought there must be a reason we have these receptors.
And nicotine is another drug that mimics, so it mimics acetylcholine, I believe, and that's how nicotine has its effect on the brain as well. Mm-hmm. So what about the other types, the other way that drugs can impact, so the ones that moderate the effect of our existing neurotransmitters or moderate the levels of our existing neurotransmitters?
Normally they would have a large effect on monoamine neurotransmitters, like I said before, but drugs such as MDMA, it works on serotonin transporters to have a really, really massive effect on the production and release of serotonin. So again, serotonin is involved in lots and lots of normal regulatory functions. It's involved in mood, appetite, again. But you see these kind of like euphoric effects because of this, these really, really large amounts of serotonin being produced. And cocaine as well is an example of a monoamine reuptake inhibitor. So normally when a neuron releases a neurotransmitter, once it kind of stimulates a receptor, it would then be taken up by the neuron into the cell, whereas cocaine would be an example of the drug blocking this action. So the chemical is then left to kind of still move around in the synapse, so you get a build-up, and it's free to stimulate many, many receptors.
And caffeine also works in that way as well, doesn't it?
So the drugs that we've talked about so far are primarily agonist drugs, so they would stimulate a receptor to cause a biological effect or to cause a, you know, an effect in the body, in the brain specifically. Whereas caffeine is an example of an antagonist. So it works on adenosine receptors. And adenosine is a neurotransmitter which makes us feel sleepy, and it builds up gradually throughout the day and makes us eventually fall asleep. So what caffeine does is it antagonizes the receptors that adenosine works on and basically blocks the effects, so it makes us feel awake. So that is a really neat example of an antagonist drug working.
Very nice. Very nice.
Thanks.
So all of what we've talked about so far has been about kind of acute intoxication effects. So what these drugs are doing in our brain when we're high, or mm-hmm. when a person is high. What kind of impact do drugs have longer term? Is that harder to research?
It is a lot harder to research. However, well, it's a good question. I think the important thing about this is that I think it's a really important point that you raise about looking at the difference between acute effects and long-term effects. So there are two main things that whenever anyone talks about drugs, then I feel the need to hammer home, is that there's a massive difference between on-drug effects and long-term effects from repeated use, and also the difference between recreational drug use and its use in medicinal settings as a possible therapy. So usually, if we are looking at on-drug effects, then that might be the stuff that we are interested in when we're looking at potential therapeutic effects of a drug, whereas long-term effects would often come from research on recreational drug users. However, they're not the same samples, and it's quite difficult to reconcile them, because if you look at a harm or some kind of adaptation to a neurotransmitter system which has come from repeated use of a recreational drug, then that is not a reason to stop or against experimenting with a drug for possible therapeutic use. However, I've gotten a bit off topic there. Long-term effects.
That's not off topic. I think that's really important.
Thanks. So, long-term effects, yeah, they are a lot harder to study. So, basically, a lot of the acute effects have come from preclinical work, animal work, understanding the basic pharmacological mechanism of action. There's a lot more studies been done in humans with long-term effects. And what you would normally do to try and study a long-term effect of any drug, really, is get a drug-using population. So, for example, a bunch of cannabis users, or a bunch of ecstasy users, or a bunch of cocaine users, or whatever it is that you're interested in researching. And you would compare them against a bunch of people that have never taken any drugs, if you can find them, and you'd compare them on, potentially you might measure a cognitive task or something like this, but there's an awful lot of kind of confounding factors in that research, in that often if you try and study, say for example, an ecstasy using group, it's quite difficult to find people that take a lot of ecstasy that haven't taken a lot of other drugs.
Yeah, polydrug use is very much, when we try and do these studies to understand the impact of different individual substances, that's not how people use drugs in the real world. Almost everyone uses it like, well, at least something like alcohol alongside mm-hmm. other drugs. And most people who use one illicit drug will potentially use other illicit drugs.
Yeah.
But before we get too much onto the human studies, I want to talk a bit more about the kind of longer-term impact at a kind of molecular level. So the type of research that's been done with animal studies, how does that feed into what we know about, for example, tolerance or withdrawal? So things like long-term changes in levels of neurotransmitters in the brain, or that kind of thing. How much do we know about what drugs do in that kind of way?
I guess there are three kind of broad long-term things that we get from animal research. So downregulation, upregulation, and neurotoxicity. Downregulation would be if you have a lot of a drug, a neurotransmitter, circulating in your brain, then your body's response to that would be to become less sensitive to the drug. So it kind of like tries to adjust itself so that it's not getting overly stimulated. What you get then is basically that you would need to take more of a drug to gain a similar effect, because you have less receptors that are basically available to stimulate. In terms of, so that could be a mechanism by which tolerance occurs, and also withdrawal as well, because if you think that a bunch of receptors have kind of like become desensitized because you're having lots and lots of circulating levels of a neurotransmitter in the brain. Then if you stop taking a drug and your body then just produces its normal amounts of that neurotransmitter, but you have far fewer active receptors available to be stimulated, then
it makes you feel like you actually have a lack of that substance.
And it ties in really well with what we know from the sort of behavioural literature, that people's motivations for taking drugs over time do change, and people do experience tolerance, needing higher doses to feel the same effect, and withdrawal, feeling awful if they stop taking a substance and finding that the way to make themselves feel better is to take that substance. So I think that kind of, you can see the potential link there between what's happening at a molecular level and what we experience if we take a substance. So what about neurotoxicity?
I guess this is kind of the idea that a drug would produce a damaging effect to a neuron, which is irreversible, I suppose, in some way, yeah.
And as you've pointed out, like, a lot of this kind of research comes from animal studies, in particular rats, but potentially primates, but mostly rats. And there are plenty of, I mean, it's just stating the blindingly obvious, but there are plenty of important differences between a rat brain and a human brain. Particularly, though, when it comes to complex things we think of as particularly human, like emotions and intelligence and consciousness, potentially. And these are kind of the things that when we take drugs, those are the things that are affected. So it's kind of those things that are particularly important to understand, like, in humans compared to rats.
Yep.
So how do we go about doing this research in humans? I think you mentioned one way, which is sort of doing these kind of neurocognitive experiments where we get a group of people who use a drug and a group of people who don't use a drug to both do sort of like a cognition task or an emotional recognition task, or, you know, that kind of thing. Not measure the brain directly, but look at behaviours that we think are related to brain processes. And you mentioned some of the limitations around that as well. So particularly polydrug use. But there are also quite a few other limitations, aren't there?
Yeah.
Things like the people who choose to use recreational drugs are different from the people who choose not to in lots of ways other than their drug use. So actually differences might have happened before drug use. People might have had different cognition levels before they ever used a drug. Yep. And actually what we're looking is causality in the opposite direction.
Yeah, and there's also kind of quite large individual variability in their susceptibility to neurobiological changes as well.
Yeah,
and also the way that we would try and get a measure of a history of drug use from a participant in a study would generally be through self-report. Which, if you think that if a lot of these drugs cause memory problems, then they might have problems kind of accurately getting a measure of how much drugs they've taken over the last 10 years. But on top of that, even if they did remember every occasion that they had taken a drug and every single amount in that episode, we have absolutely no idea at all of the purity of that drug. So what you're left with is a lot of guessing at, you know, we don't have the real detailed information on patterns of use, and we don't, you know, have really kind of a good handle on differences between, you know, kind of effects of sporadic use with long periods of abstinence. Most of these substances have been investigated individually, and most of them suffer from a lack of these kind of like longitudinal studies on prospective users to kind of see, you know, the
impact over time.
And then also another caveat is that we don't know an awful lot about recovery with abstinence from drug use as well.
And also, going back to self-report, people might not feel very confident in disclosing information about illicit drug use.
Yeah.
So what other ways are there then that we can look at this question? So what about things like neuroimaging?
Yeah, well, neuroimaging is another really interesting part of this because we understand a lot more about brain function from a lot of the animal research as well. This can inform areas of the brain that might be of specific interest from neuroimaging research. Sometimes some of the kind of like cognitive effects of prolonged drug use can actually be quite subtle, whereas sometimes certain neuroimaging techniques can detect structural or functional brain changes prior to a behavioural manifestation as well.
Yeah, so what are the different kinds of neuroimaging techniques that we can use?
Right, okay. A good way to assess the amount of receptors available in the brain is to use positive emission tomography. So this would use kind of labelling a neurotransmitter with a radio tracer. And what would happen then is that would bind to the receptors that it kind of has an affinity for, and you'll be able to image
the amount of receptors available. So this could potentially show you the amount of downregulation or the amount of receptors available in a specific area of the brain. So what you might have is you might be particularly interested in some areas of the brain where there are an awful lot of cannabinoid receptors or there are an awful lot of serotonin receptors, and you might see that there would be some kind of like reduction in them areas with use.
And that's a PET scan.
PET scan. You can have magnetic resonance imaging as well, which can tell you information about brain structure as well as blood flow. So the idea of these studies is that the amount of blood kind of pumping to an area of the brain is a proxy for neuronal firing. And you can imagine that if you have degradation to a bunch of receptors in the brain, that there might be kind of like reduced blood flow to them areas or increased to make up for downregulation or something like this. Yeah.
So it seems like from this way that we can tell sort of a little bit about potential long-term risks or harms from regular use of various substances. What about, can we tell whether any of these risks or harms are reversible? I think it's very difficult. It's one of those things, isn't it, where it's hard to do research into illicit drugs anyway. And the more sort of fine-grained your question is, the more difficult it is to recruit samples and that kind of thing. The longer scale you need for people who've previously used a substance regularly then stopped.
Yeah, I would say that with most substances that have been studied, then the findings are mixed.
Yeah.
Basically, yeah.
I think this seems like a really good time to bring in our first question from the audience. If that's all right. I should also say that if there's some unusual background noise, it's because there's a little baby in here. So it just goes to show that your children are never too young to get educated about drugs.
Hi, thank you very much.
Hello.
My question is this. There are two observations in the literature regarding how drugs work, which the way I see it, they contradict each other. The one is that people that take drugs, the drugs work on their nucleus accumbens in a way that every time they take them, the drug, the brain considers that a novel stimulus. So every time it's like the first time. And that makes the reward-driven learning associated with drugs much stronger compared to other natural rewards. That's on the one hand. On the other hand, we also know that it's really difficult for drug users to go back to that very first high, the experience, the first time they used the drug. So how do these two go together?
So you mentioned the nucleus accumbens. So, I mean, obviously,
do you want to say a little bit about what the nucleus accumbens is?
So the nucleus accumbens is a very small structure in the brain, which is located in the ventral striatum. And it is quite an important component of what we consider our mesocortico-limbic reward system.
Or reward system.
So basically, there are a lot of drugs in the brain tend to work on what we term like a reward system. The nucleus accumbens seems to be an area of this reward system which most drugs do have an effect on.
And people take drugs because they enjoy taking drugs. I think that's an important point to mention, that sort of it's not surprising that drugs are associated with the reward pathway because that's why people take them, at least initially.
Yeah. I think what you're kind of talking about there in terms of novelty of drug use in the first instance kind of signalling something that would make you want to take it again. Or like, so it's I think this feeds into, do you know the incentive sensitization?
Yeah.
What I should say is that, okay, right. So basically what I think
is happening
there.
I'm just going to make you explain it.
What I think is happening there is that this novelty thing would come under the term wanting, where there's parts in the nucleus accumbens which are particularly important for salience orienteering. So things in the environment becoming, well, salient to you, and one thing that might become salient to you would be a reward. However, salience and reward in this example are independent of one another. So liking, which can be mediated by other areas of the reward system as well as other neurochemicals as well. So a drug can sensitize your brain to want to take a drug very, very quickly, whilst you still, the pleasure that you get from taking it reduces over time. So they're not really, they don't really correlate. The amount that you, a drug is perceived as being something that you want doesn't necessarily correlate with the pleasure that you get from taking it. The idea is that that change in the brain for you to orienteer towards a drug reward or whatever can work also independently of a real life cognitive evaluation of what you want to do, which would be like more prefrontal cortex kind of thinking about it. And this is kind of almost like an implicit kind of thing. So yeah, I think that them kind of changes can happen very, very quickly and can last for a long time as well, even after you kind of stop taking drugs as well. Is that anywhere near what you were after?
Okay. And I think it's also important to point out that the vast majority of people who use drugs won't develop a disordered pattern of use. Most people who use drugs not to a sort of addiction level. So that also can impact on how quickly tolerance builds up, how severe withdrawal symptoms are, and how likely this is to keep this kind of... I mean, I'm not a brain area expert, which is why I got Carl along, and why I'm making him answer all the difficult questions. But as to my understanding, it's why the kind of brain firing could remain rewarding for people who aren't, who don't develop problematic use.
Yeah, I think, well, I think that's another really important distinction to make, is that problematic drug use and kind of compulsive use is actually, you know, a very, very small proportion of the population, of even of drug users as well. So not all drug users will go on to become problematic drug users. There's only, I think it's like 30% of something like this, which might go on to kind of have more compulsive drug use. But if you think that it's a really, really small number of all drug users that might potentially have a neurobiological vulnerability for compulsion, and then spread that across several different drugs. So you have things that work on an opioid system, you have things that work on a cannabinoid system, you have serotonergic drugs, you have drugs that work on dopamine. So there's such variability of the mechanism of how these drugs act that there are going to be different types of people that have different problems with different drugs.
So yeah, can we sum up the entire answer to that question as, turns out it's quite complicated? Great. Right, let's move on to the next question.
It's certainly more complicated than I understand.
Okay. So far we've kind of covered animal studies of intoxication and neuroimaging studies of long-term use. What about combining the two? What about neuroimaging studies while people are intoxicated?
We're really in the infancy of these, but they're really mega exciting.
Tell me more.
tell me about it. I will. Give me some time. So there was a study in 2016 that came out, which was the first, I think it was the first fMRI study. And so there's this group, the Beckley Imperial Research Group, so it's funded by the Beckley Foundation, done in Imperial. Robin Carhart-Harris is the kind of
friend of the podcast.
And they gave their participants LSD, and they did these scans, the fMRI scans, where they did analysis called functional connectivity. So the idea is that if various regions of the brain are activated at the same time, that they have some kind of functional significance. And their kind of finding is that under LSD, under the influence of LSD, that people's brains start, normally segregated areas of the brain start to communicate with each other. So basically it's proposed that it enhances communication between areas of the brain that wouldn't normally communicate with each other, and therefore this might underlie an escape from kind of like rigid cognition. So basically what's happening is, with these drugs, they are conducting drugs to find out mechanisms of how they affect the brain so that they can gain insight to how they then might be useful in therapy in some way. Now, with this particular one, this kind of break from rigid cognition might help in a kind of psychotherapy setting to help kind of treat things like depression or be used in talk therapies where people find it difficult to open up?
Well, would you believe we have a question from the audience that is exactly on along these lines?
So I am actually quite interested in psychedelics.
Nice t-shirt.
Oh, thank you, yeah. Do you like the song Roses?
Yeah.
got a bit off topic.
Off podcast, yeah. Guys.
So I've been looking at the research into psychedelics, and there's a lot of stuff suggesting that, like you said, the study's saying that it's good for openness and creativity and that sort of thing. And quite a few things suggesting that it could be used to alleviate depression, anxiety, maybe even severe drug addiction. But it's usually in the setting of using it as sort of medication. But then you look at how it's used as, for example, DMT is used in ayahuasca and by the shamans in the Amazon, but they don't just administer the drug. They've got a specific sort ritual, of routine or ritual around it, which is there's songs involved in certain dances sometimes. And that seems to affect how effective it is in actually treating these problems. So my question is, what is the actual potential for using it in a therapeutic setting? And I'm not just talking CBT, like could there be a therapy itself that is based around psychedelic use in the same way that it's used in therapy, I guess you could call it that, by the shamans in the Amazon, or with Iboga in Africa that's used for drug addiction, things like that. Yeah, what's the potential for that?
Great question. I think there is an awful lot of potential for a lot of psychedelic drugs to be used in various therapeutic forms. I know that psilocybin mushrooms are currently in phase 2 clinical trials for depression because they seem to have an effect on mood. So basically, with clinical trials, you have your phase 1 and your phase 2 where their trials are built around kind of establishing efficacy and dose, really, so kind of people that can tolerate them and they want to get the dosing right. With drugs like this and like ayahuasca,
which is DMT,
so yeah,
the active ingredient rather is DMT in ayahuasca.
The idea is that unlike other medications for things like depression or anxiety or whatever that you would take on a daily basis, the idea is that something like a powerful psychedelic drug or hallucinogen might catalyze a profound life-changing vision or a an experience that can give you insight to kind of like gain control of things. You mentioned Iboga and Ibogaine and the treatment that they use there. What happens is that people take this drug and they have this quite intense hallucinatory episode for like 12 hours, I think it is. I don't think it's very pleasant. And then they come out of it and there's a window, especially with like opiate addiction, they have a window of a couple of days where they don't have any withdrawal symptoms from heroin. And I've pointed at you, like you take it then, you know, right, heroin. And that's like a good window and a good opportunity for them to seek psychological assistance that they might need. What else are we talking about? Ayahuasca. Yeah, so ayahuasca being used by shamans, etc. in the Amazon. I think the stuff about kind of chanting and the rituals is really, really interesting and really cool. And I think that feeds into some stuff that you are interested in with like kind of set and setting and stuff like that.
Yeah,
well,
absolutely. I think in terms of use for therapeutic reasons, there's a couple of different ways that these therapies are being conducted at the moment. And small plug alert, there's actually a mini series of 3 episodes of the Say Why to Drugs podcast that you are listening to right now, which are specifically about therapeutic medicine. Interviews with Dr. Ben Sessa, Professor Celia Morgan, and Dr. Albert Garcia Romeo, who are doing work using MDMA, ketamine, and psilocybin, I think, but also are involved in research into other psychedelics. Or, like, I mean, ketamine and MDMA, you could sort of debate whether they're not classic psychedelics, but they do have some sort of impact like that. But there are 2 different ways that these kind of therapies work. Both of them involve also talking to a therapist, but you either talk while intoxicated or you have an intoxication experience and then have your therapy session sort of directly after or soon after. So that, well, the way that Albert, who I interviewed, described it to me was like you wouldn't talk all the way through a film. So you watch the film, you experience the intoxication effect, and then you talk about it with your therapist afterwards. And it's so both of these ways are quite kind of interesting methods of dealing with it, and we're still very much at the early stages in terms of the science of understanding this. It's at the moment it's kind of open label trials where the, I mean, it's quite hard to blind someone as to whether they've taken a psychedelic drug or not, but we're still kind of at the stage where, as Carl was saying, it's working out tolerability and side effects and that kind of thing, but it's looking really promising.
There's so with ayahuasca specifically, there's been an observational study, I think, for seeing how effective it might be for I think it's addiction. It's on the do you know the website MAP? Are we allowed to plug a website?
Yeah.
MAPS. They've got a big kind of index on there of all of the clinical trials and all of the studies that are being conducted at the moment with psychedelic drugs. So it'll be on there. I think that they're probably trying to take it into some one of the phase one or phase two trials, but I don't think that they're I don't think there's been any controlled studies with it yet. I know that just as an aside, the with ayahuasca, because it contains the carpi vine? So the vine is a monoamine oxidase inhibitor, and so there's another plant in it which has the DMT, and the DMT doesn't work unless it has the monoamine oxidase inhibitors in there as well. So this brew contains quite a complicated mixture of chemicals.
Interaction.
Yeah, yeah. So, and I know that if you read some of the stuff about the shamans in the Amazon and stuff, they would talk about how, so people, if you ask them how they knew that these plants would work together to produce these effects, they would tell you that the plants told them to do it. That's good, isn't it?
So the thing that gets me about all of this is, apart from the brilliant little factoids that have been peppered throughout this, is we're getting to understand fairly well the kind of molecular, cellular, neurotransmitter level effects that we see in animals and in brain studies. But how well do these actually relate to the kind of, or how well do we understand the relationship between what we see at a molecular level and what we experience? So, and particularly with something like psychedelics, where we know so little about consciousness, and this is kind of a change in consciousness. I don't know, I feel like that's kind of exciting, but also it's kind of the great unknown of how we understand, like, how does a change in the brain affect our perception of the world? Go on, answer that.
No, it is, it is really interesting. That's...
Insert hand wavy gesture here. But I think that also boils down to, we sort of briefly touched on it there, this idea of set and setting, that you can take a substance in two different environments and it can have a completely different effect on you, and or you can take an environment when you're in two different moods and it can have a really different effect on you. And we even see this with alcohol, as I'm sure people in this room have experienced, drinking the same amount of alcohol on two different nights and having feeling vastly differently drunk on those two different nights. And like, some of that's probably to do with whether you've eaten before or other things, but some of it is due to how you feel or where you are. People can drink more at home than they can when they're out because their body somehow adjusts to where they are. And you see this in people who use heroin as well. If you use heroin in an environment where you've used heroin previously, you can take more, and if you use it in a novel environment, you're at a higher risk of overdose. And like, understanding why this is something that really, really fascinates me. But I think that is probably a good point to open it up to questions and or philosophical points or anything that you'd like to add. Thank you for listening. Does anybody have any questions?
Yeah, so based on the research that you guys are aware of, are there any important, maybe like other similarities or differences between the negative effects on the brain of, say, chemical stimuli from like excessive drug use, or maybe visual stimuli from like excessive viewing of pornography or something like that?
Ooh. So is the question kind of addiction related to substances versus addiction related to something like online pornography?
Yeah, like how analogous are the two things, if at all?
It's a really good question, and it's what quite often happens in sort of media representation of this is we get our old friend the nucleus accumbens mentioned as saying, well, we see nucleus accumbens firing in people who compulsively watch pornography, so therefore it's as addictive as crack, or I don't know. I saw someone refer to smartphones as digital cocaine yesterday and I got annoyed.
I don't know, really. I think that... I dare say if this is wrong, we can chop it out of the podcast, can't we? I would imagine, based on nothing at all, really, this is just... I would imagine that... So what happens with things like viewing pornography? This is like a natural reward response, I guess, whatever is produced in the brain in response to that. And I would imagine that it would be difficult to kind of naturally produce to such great extent the same way that you can chemically induce it.
And I think, like, obviously drugs have physiological effects as well as effects on the brain, which are partly caused by the effects that they have on the brain, but, you know, things like stimulants can put strain on your heart, so if you regularly take stimulants you're at increased risk of things like heart attack. I'm not aware of any studies that, because I imagine looking at porn increases your heart rate, but I'm not aware of any studies of people who compulsively watch porn that they are experiencing sort of those physiological changes as well. So while I think that there are kind of some similarities in terms of the sort of, I don't know, I mean, you can have an argument about how to define addiction anyway, but the way that I think is quite a good way is that you sort of change your life and your behaviour around this drug or this activity potentially. And I do think that substances are in a different class to things like watching porn or shopping. Maybe gambling is more like substance use in terms of the sort of, it can have an stronger negative effect on your life kind of maybe more quickly than something like too much porn. But yeah, it's something that we don't understand very well, actually. And I think so there's kind of a disagreement in the research community as well, with some people thinking that, yeah, they are related and you can be addicted to anything if you do it enough, and some people thinking that drugs are a special case and there's something sort of category difference between them. But it's a really good question, and sorry that we don't have a better answer. Blame science.
It's a really good question. Is there anybody, because I know there's a few people in the addiction research group, do you have anything to add about... No, it doesn't matter. You're not on the stand, it's fine.
Any other questions?
I remember hearing years ago that taking ecstasy or MDMA creates holes in your brain or something like this, or increases the kind of blank spaces in the brain. Is that true? Is that based on animals? Have we found that in humans?
I know the answer to this because I covered it in my MDMA podcast, available now on acast.com/saywhytodrugs. It was a paper that's since been retracted because the person doing it labelled their vials of chemicals wrong, and the drug that they thought was MDMA was actually not MDMA. It was methamphetamine, yeah.
It caused dopamine neurotoxicity is what they found, wasn't it? And then they had to retract it.
Yeah. But it got a lot of media coverage at the time, but the retraction, surprisingly enough, got less media coverage. So plenty of people still go around thinking that's true, but yeah, it's a good question.
You mentioned earlier the setting of drug taking impacts the effect, the influence of the drug. Do you reckon that has any influence on clinical implications if it's done in clinical trials, and if so, what?
Great question. I think that's a really good question.
Yeah, it's a really good question. No, it's that is, I think, fundamental to doing the research in a clinical setting, is that they are trying their best to control the environment in which it is giving to produce the optimum effects with a drug that is very unpredictable.
No, I absolutely agree that if you keep everything as consistent as possible, then you minimise the impact of of the effect of setting.
Yeah, and these studies of these drugs, which potentially have these therapeutic effects, are often in very small samples, which is a necessary limitation, because basically what they're doing currently in this area is gaining credibility. The research community, to prove
probably have to try even harder with these drugs to prove that they may be beneficial because there is such negativity around them. But on top of that is because there was a lot of research done in the 50s and 60s with LSD that was really, really bad and was really, really unscientific and really uncontrolled. And it's really been quite damaging to psychedelic research reputation. And so now research is being done in very, very small samples with, you know, kind of really, really control in a really, really controlled manner. And one of the important things to get correct is trying to control the setting that people take them in. But because it's such an unpredictable, they are quite unpredictable drugs.
Yeah. But I think you're right in that how do we know what's the best setting to have the best effect? And I think that's something that's quite.
Yeah, it's probably not in an fMRI scanner, is it?
Well, so David Nutt, who was involved in those in the psilocybin in MRI scanner paper, used to be at Bristol where I was before he moved to Imperial. And before he ever ran the study in a scanner, he created a cardboard MRI scanner in one of the top floor rooms in one of the buildings in Bristol, where he ran sort of initial proof of concept of this, where he got people to take psilocybin and go in the cardboard scanner to just see how, because obviously I don't know if anyone in here has had a brain scan, but it's pretty claustrophobic. It's not, I mean, I've had a couple and I found myself getting quite anxious in the scanner because you're really enclosed. You have to keep your head completely still, which is obviously potentially slightly challenging if you're tripping as well. So he ran the study in a cardboard scanner to sort of work out whether people would actually tolerate being in a scanner. And so obviously the setting there is extremely important. You need to make, or more the set actually, is like, is this person kind of relaxed enough and feels safe enough that they're not going to absolutely freak out when they're put into a brain scanner? Because also if you have to ever what's called quench a brain scanner, like if for some reason something goes badly wrong and you need to, like, you'd never turn a MRI scanner off, and if you have to turn it off, it basically explodes the top off it and it costs you millions of pounds to fix. So you really don't want anything going wrong that could damage your scanner. So these tolerability ideas were really important. But I think also to come back to a point that Carl made earlier as well about the sort of the literature kind of in the past maybe being a bit discredited. It's not necessarily that it wasn't sort of bad, awful research. It's just that we've got better at kind of designing these studies. So the ketamine study that is mentioned in an episode of my podcast with Professor Celia Morgan has done. She's looking at the use of ketamine for alcohol dependency. And that's actually based on research that was done in Russia, I think it was, in the 60s. And the research itself was kind of interesting and fine, but it wasn't designed particularly well. The sort of control group wasn't particularly, or maybe there wasn't one, I can't remember now. But taking these ideas and these interesting studies that maybe weren't designed very well and rerunning them now, when public attitudes are changing as well, yeah. And I think that's hugely important in there's a bit of a swell that people are going, hang on, these drugs could potentially have really useful benefits. And actually there's loads of drugs that we think of as recreational drugs, or like, to use an awful phrase, drugs of abuse, that also have incredible benefits. So like ketamine is on the World Health Organization's list of essential medicine. Morphine, heroin are almost indistinguishable. Even caffeine is on the World Health Organization's list of essential medicines as well, not just for early mornings when you've had a late night. Drugs can have more than one effect is the point I'm half-fistedly kind of making. I think
you were saying about some of these psychedelic studies that were conducted that have been improved upon, and there was actually an awful lot of studies at the time, and there are some really, really insightful things that we can get from them.
Yeah, we've probably got time for one more question if anyone's got one.
There's a lot of research about amphetamine use for like recreation. Do people who use amphetamines recreationally, are they different from people who use it for work purposes, like Adderall addicts? Or
so cognitive enhancers question.
Cognitive enhancers.
I don't know of any studies that have looked at. Sorry to interrupt.
It's all right. I was flapping.
I don't know of any studies that have looked at directly comparing people who like use speed versus people who are prescribed D-amphetamine for ADHD versus people who use prescribed D-amphetamine for as a cognitive enhancer? Because I would imagine that those three different groups would be quite different in terms of their sort of, well, their motivations for using are obviously very different. So yeah. I think it's quite likely that they themselves would have quite different demographics as well. But I don't know whether anyone's actually looked into that.
No, but it's an interesting point that amphetamines are prescribed for, or amphetamine derivatives are prescribed for ADHD. Obviously, they have quite a high abuse potential. But there are other drugs that are prescribed for ADHD which don't have as high abuse potential but are still being used in healthy populations without ADHD to enhance cognition. So, like you were saying, it's the motivation to use is...
it's going to have an impact on the type of person that chooses to do that. But now you've got me thinking about a research idea. And that is the best thing that comes out of these is when I go, oh, I could write a grant about that. So thank you very much. Would you like to be a co-author?
I would.
That is a whole hour. I'm going to have to edit this. Oh, gosh. Thank you, everyone, so much for listening. I hope it was interesting and entertaining. Edutainment. I hope you enjoyed it. I'm going to cut that out for a start. Thank you all so much for being part of this, and we will be out there if you want to come and chat to us as well. Thanks a lot.
And there we are. This was a bit of an experiment. I wasn't really sure how a live podcast would work, so I'd love to know what you think of the live format. Let me know on Twitter, join the Facebook group, or send me an email. Carrier pigeon, I don't mind. I'd love to do some more if you think people would be interested. Let me know topics, potential guests, anything. Now, I promised you some news, and here it is. I've been busy recently because I'm working on Say Why to Drugs, the book, which is very exciting. To me, anyway, hopefully to you guys as well. It's already available to pre-order on Amazon. I hope you guys like it. I'll be back in 2 weeks' time with another special episode. Earlier this year, I spoke to Jenny Valentish about her book Woman of Substances. And then there'll be more to come in the new year as well. But for now, thank you so much for coming back and joining the podcast after all these months. Speak soon. Bye.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic-butter shrimp scampi. Mm. HelloFresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.